اومجنس من اندسیاه زنان دراصل کیا چکسوس ملتان دین اتس مای سویگر وینا مها سوی تیتانی منو بیستام ستپیتان دین بوتلی سایم دمائم دداتی سپندن دکم بان سکو پردو بستا کریپسن دو بای بتا پتیتنم بابی نیدو باشی نیدو نمونا ما Reading from the sixth chapter of the ninth canto of the Bhagavatam. In this chapter, there is a main pastime, a story told at the end, the story of Subari Muni. But continuing here, there are many short pastimes. You have a cold, don't you? Oh, poor thing. Yeah? Why don't you take care of her? Invite your MP, local MP. So there are many little pastimes and stories as we trace the descendants of the different Manus, of the different kings. And they will lead, ultimately, to the birth of Lord Krishna, which begins in the, or starts speaking about that just at the end of the ninth canto, and of course the entire tenth canto of the Bhagavatam is dedicated to the different pastimes and activities of Lord Krishna. But in these tracings of the different dynasties, there's always very interesting little incidents that occur that are very instructive. So we'll start just at the beginning and perhaps we'll finish the chapter. Sukadeva Goswami said, so we've just completed the in the last two chapters hearing about Maharaj Ambarish and how dear. In the pastime of Maharaj Ambarish, what we learned was not only is the Lord by definition, of course, if someone is a devotee of God, how he's devoted to God, and therefore the Lord is very dear to him. But in hearing about Maharaj Ambarish, we didn't just hear how God was dear to his servant, to the devotee, but we heard how dear the devotee was to the Lord. And now, having heard the different pastimes of Maharaj Ambarish, his descendants will be named. Sukadeva Goswami said, I feel a little bit sad that this is the ninth canto of a very long book, I'm sure it's hard to pick it up from the ninth canto. But anyway, I'll just continue and we'll see what happens. So Sukadeva Goswami was speaking to a king named Maharaj Prickett. He said, O Maharaj Prickett, Ambarish had three sons named Virupa, Ketuman, Shambhu. From Virupa came a son named Prisadhaswa, and from Prisadhasya came a son named Ritatara. Ritatara had no sons, and therefore he requested the great sage Angira to beget sons for him. Because of this request, Angira begot sons in the womb of Ratiatara's wife. All these sons were born with brahminical prowess. So this particular social convention, when someone wasn't able to beget children and his wife, in previous times they could request powerful persons to do that. Here in this day and age, everything is so sexually oriented that the whole consciousness, the whole etiquette, all the dealings are quite different. So it's hard to imagine this in this day and age, but in previous times this was done. And actually in this day and age, as the verse will be quoted later, certain things that were previously legitimate are now considered illegitimate, and this type of a thing is now considered illegitimate. But because of Angira being a sage, and because of him begetting the children within the womb of a warrior, of a Kshatriya lady, there are, the children who were born had those type of mixed qualities. So they were both known, as we'll hear, as they will be considered brahmanas, they will be considered sages because of their father. Having been born from the womb of Ratitara's wife, all these sons were known as the dynasty of Rahitara. But because they were born from the semen of Angira, they were also known as the dynasty of Angira. Among all the progeny of Ratitara, these sons were the most prominent because owing to their birth, they were considered Brahmins. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments, or Prabhupada comments in his purport, quoting Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, saying, the word is dvijataya, which means they have two castes, or mixed birth of not one quality. Nowadays, there is this type of breeding, so to speak, where people of one particular section of society would usually intermarry within that section of society, that in the Western culture, at least externally, it isn't considered to be a good thing, because theoretically in the Western culture, everyone is free to do as they like, become as they like, but actually that theory isn't practiced in every culture. People actually like to marry people of the same mentality, of the same nationality, of the same religion. Why? Because in that way the marriage will be peaceful, because the people think in the same way. Because if people think and they've been brought up in a particular way, then it's much easier for the husband and wife to get along. And nowadays, although theoretically it's so wonderful that anyone can do what they want and marry who they want and there's no limitation and everything is based on love, but what percentages of those marriages actually succeed from in the sense of lasting and longevity? So theoretically something is trying to be accomplished, but actually because it's based on artificial principles, opposite results occur, and the people will not admit that some of their basic premises are wrong. For instance, a society is based on premises of lust and greed and acquirement of unlimited material goods, that this is the purpose of life, and everyone just tried to enjoy as much sense pleasure as possible. Watch as much TV as you can, go to the movies, have your the sports, have music going on 24 hours a day, keep your earphones always plugged in, have your phone running, as much sensual stimulation as possible, as if this would make, the propaganda basically is that the more that the senses are satisfied, the more we become satisfied. But in actuality, the more the senses are satisfied, the less satisfied we become. And the more dissatisfaction comes, the more frustration comes, and unhappiness, and ultimately insanity basically comes due to all the unfulfilled desires and imagining that other people have things that we don't have, or that we see, but then imagining only if, and then envy enters in the heart. So a very sad state the society is in, where everyone is in so much anxiety, no peace. Everyone is dreaming that in the future I'm going to be happy if I do this, if I'm able to do that. On this sensual level, and the advertising just winds up everyone's minds, and the continuous sensuality just disturbs everyone's mind, and therefore rather than being happy, everyone is very, very, very filled with anxiety and fear and frustration. So much so that people just turn to intoxication just to relieve, or what does intoxication do? It adds more illusion. Everyone is already an illusion. But the pain of the illusion that everyone in it is so great that their only recourse is to add more layers to dull the pain through different intoxications and watching television continuously, and that's not satisfying enough, so videos and everything, just living, going from one illusory moment to the next, because no one wants to face reality, and the reality is the dissatisfaction everyone has in the heart. So in any case, one of the simple principles of satisfaction in married life is people have to have a similar mentality. So therefore, for the children to have be brought up in a peaceful way, then the husband and the wife, the parents, should be happily married. So society is very stable. So people were intermarried in their own group. But in this particular case, the sage begat the children in the king's wife's womb, and therefore the children were of a mixed caste. So the son of Manu was Ikshaku. So we know that from the Bhagavad Gita. When Manu was sneezing, Ikshaku was born from Manu's nostrils. King Ikshaku had 100 sons, so there's not anything more said about this, that fantastic piece of information. Of whom he had 100 sons, of whom Vikukshi, Nimi, and Dandaka were the most prominent. Of the 100 sons, 25 became kings in the western side of Aryavarta, a place between the Himalayas and the Vindhya Mountains. Another 25 sons became kings to the east of Aryavarta, and the three principal sons became kings in the middle. The other sons became kings in various other places. During the months of January, February, and March, oblations offered to the forefathers are called Astaka Shraddha. The Shraddha ceremony is held during the dark fortnight of the month. When Maharaj Ikshaku was performing his oblations in this ceremony, he ordered his son Vikukshi to go immediately to the forest to bring some pure flesh. Thereafter, Ikshaku's son Vikukshi went to the forest and killed many animals suitable for being offered as oblations, being offered in the particular type of sacrifice. But when fatigued and hungry, he became forgetful and ate a rabbit he had killed. Here's Prabhupada's purport. It is evident that Kshatriyas killed animals in the forest. Kshatriyas means warriors, or the warrior caste. It is evident that Kshatriyas killed animals in the forest because the flesh of the animals was suitable to be offered at a particular type of sacrifice, a jagya. Offering oblations to the forefathers in the ceremony known as Shraddha is also a kind of jagya or sacrifice. In this jagya, flesh obtained from the forest by hunting could be offered. However, in the present age, Kali Yuga, this kind of offering is forbidden. Quoting from the Brahma Vavarta Purana, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, Asvamedham gavalambam sanyasam palapaitrakam devarena sutotpatim kalopanshavavarjayet. In this age of Kali, 5 acts are forbidden. These were allowed in previous ages that were purer, but in the age of Kali, the age of confusion and quarrel, these 5 acts are not allowed, they are disallowed. The first is the offering of a horse in sacrifice. The offering of a cow in sacrifice is the second. The acceptance of the order of sannyas is the third. The offering of oblations of flesh to the forefathers, which was the item particularly mentioned, and a man's begetting children and his brother's wife. The word palapaitrakam refers to an offering of flesh and oblations to forefathers. Formerly, such an offering was allowed, but in this age, it is forbidden. In this age, Kali Yuga, everyone is expert in hunting animals, but most of the people are sudras. They are very of a lower quality, not kshatriyas, warriors. According to Vedic injunctions, however, only kshatriyas or warriors are allowed to hunt, whereas sudras are allowed to eat flesh after offering goats or other insignificant animals before the deity of the goddess Kali or similar demigod. So things were very structured and restricted and regulated. So meat eating, it was seen that there is always a class of person who wishes to eat meat. But the reactions that come from killing an animal just for the satisfaction of one's tongue are so great that there are always restrictions upon it, although it is allowed to some degree, but it is always allowed in a restricted fashion. So once a month, the lower class personalities could take a goat on the dark moon night, the Amavasya it is called, and on a far corner of the village they would perform a sacrifice. And part of that sacrifice, where that goat would actually be killed, and it would be killed by that person as part of the sacrifice. And part of that sacrifice, he would whisper a mantra within the goat's ear. And what did that mantra say? Do you know? In this life, yes, in this life, you're an eternal soul and I'm an eternal soul. And right now, that which is giving life to your body, the soul, is in a goat's body, and I'm in a human body, I'm in the superior position. And because I have a taste for eating flesh, I will kill you in the sacrifice. But in the next time, in the next life, you can have the opportunity to kill me. So imagine how many times, if you said this mantra, after a while it would dawn on one that it's not actually worth it at all. Just to satisfy one's tongue, when one doesn't actually need meat to survive, to live, to be strong, to be healthy. One doesn't need meat, but yet, to satisfy the tongue, look what I'm doing. Not only am I causing pain, someone can be so callous and not think that they're causing pain to others or don't care about that, even though there's so much pain and so much reaction to the suffering one's causing another. But even if one is so callous that one doesn't care about that or doesn't perceive that, but one will gradually understand that if I'm going to be killed in the next life, I don't like it. I don't like that thought. And then naturally one thinks, well, he doesn't like it either. Why am I doing this? So in the Vedic system, certain things were allowed, but when they're regulated and done in a sacrificial way, in a scriptural way, they bring great purification in time. And things that are unfavorable for one's life, material life or spiritual life, they are gradually given up if one uses this Vedic system. But although meat eating was allowed in its restricted way in the Vedic times, there was never provision for something as inhumane as a slaughterhouse, where the animals are brought together, they're fed, they're taken care of, they're given up naturally. These type of domestic animals, they take shelter of humans. But when there is a conspiracy to kill them in a slaughterhouse, and the purpose of them, their life is to be killed like that. There is so much sin attached to such a thing. It's a conspiracy against the animals. And the animals know that they're going to be killed. And they're in so much anxiety. One time I was driving in the United States between two cities in California, from Los Angeles and to San Francisco, and in the middle of the desert, and I remember it was on the eastern side because it's so much stuck in my mind, there was a slaughterhouse, an abattoir, and there were cows there, and of course I didn't, we were just passing it as we drove, but and we could understand why it was in the desert too, because the animals were crying. They were bellowing and crying in anxiety. Another example of inhumaneness. And how can we expect a peaceful world when these kind of things are going on, when we want people to be humane in dealing with each other, but completely callous to the suffering of a poor animal which is helpless. They were just bellowing in fear and anxiety to no avail, I'm sure. So although there was meat eating allowed in a restricted way, it was such a thing as a slaughterhouse was completely disallowed. No one would conceive of doing such a horrible thing. And the people would have to kill the animals themselves and other things in this way for the purpose of purification. On the whole, meat eating is not completely forbidden. A particular class of men is allowed to eat meat according to various circumstances and injunctions. As far as eating beef or the cow is concerned, however, it is strictly prohibited to everyone. Thus, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna personally speaks of Goraksham, Krishi Goraksham Vanilam, cow protection. Meat eaters, according to their different positions and the directions of the Shastra, the scriptures, are allowed to eat flesh, but never the flesh of cows. Cows must be given all protection. There are so many reasons for this. One is that the cow is considered like a mother. Why? Because when we're young, we survive on our mother's milk. So what do they do in contemporary, and Prabhupada would generally not say civilization, he would say so-called civilization, because the people, he would not give them the grace and the credit for being civilized, because especially because of this cow killing. India is teased and made fun of because of the holy cow, the sacred cow. But when the cow gives milk and then it becomes old and it can't give milk anymore, if it's not efficient, what do? They just kill it. Kill their own mothers in that way. What a horrible consciousness. It's so exploitive. You use something as long as it's good for you. You exploit it, you squeeze what you want from it, then when it's no longer useful to you, or it's not economically profitable, you kill it and eat it. Such an insane, cruel, heartless mentality. No wonder we see what's going on today. People, young children walking into schools angrily with guns and shooting people. Crazy. But these are the crazinesses that we don't protest about, that go on before our eyes, practically speaking. Such cruelty is there, such heartlessness. If one just goes around a cow, what happens? Immediately, because the cows are such gentle animals, immediately one feels peaceful. It's actually quite an amazing thing. Even if you think about a cow, if you have any experience with cows, if you think about a cow, cows are so auspicious that the mind becomes peaceful and the heart becomes satisfied. What to speak of killing these innocent animals? They have no defense. What do? They take grass. We don't eat grass. They take grass and eat the grass, and in the miracle of their bodies, they turn that grass into the most nourishing food that a person can just live on. Cow's milk, if he has nothing else to eat, he can survive. And instead, what do? They turn they try to increase the production of the cows. How? They pump the cows up with antibiotics and growth hormones. And instead of taking the natural way to become healthy and happy, by taking the milk of the cow, they eat the cow. They do everything opposite of God's way. And this is a demonic so-called civilization. So cows must be given all protection, Prabhupada explains in the purport. So this, that was somewhat tangential, but Ikshaku, his son Vikukshi, went to bring some animal's flesh to be sacrificed in a particular Vedic ceremony, but he ate some of the flesh. And then when he returned, as text 8 says, Vikukshi offered the remnants of the flesh to King Ikshaku, who gave it to Vashishta, the priest, for purification and to be offered in the sacrifice. But Vashishta was very powerful and perceptive, so he could immediately understand that part of the flesh had been taken by Vikukshi, and therefore he said that it was unfit to be used in the Shraddha ceremony. Purport. That which is meant to be offered in jagya or in sacrifice, offered to God in some way or another, cannot be tasted by anyone before being offered to the deity. In our temples, Prabhupada says, this regulation is in effect. One cannot eat food from the kitchen unless it is offered to the deity. If something is taken before being offered to the deity, the entire preparation is polluted and can no longer be offered. So, all the food that we eat is first offered to God, and then we eat the remnants. And if someone eats something without it being offered to God, then it cannot be offered to God because it's been tasted already. He gets the first taste, and then we can get the remnants. Not he gets our remnants. Those engaged in deity worship, Prabhupada continues, must know this very well so that they may be saved from committing offenses in deity worship. Text 9. So what happened? He ate something. He forgot what it was meant for, and he ate some of the flesh of the animal and then tried to offer in sacrifice, but the priest understood that it was contaminated already, so he wouldn't accept it. So when the King Ikshaku, his father, when he was informed by Vashishta, he understood what his son Vikukshi had done. He was extremely angry. Thus he ordered Vikukshi to leave the country because Vikukshi had violated the regulative principles. Having been instructed by the great and learned Brahmana Vashishta, who discoursed about the absolute truth, Maharaj Ikshaku became renowned. So he was performing sacrifices and sacrifices, the king. And then gradually, towards the end of his life, he became renounced. He gave up being king. And by following the principles for a yogi, he certainly achieved the supreme perfection after giving up his material body. So he became very renounced. After his father's disappearance, Vikukshi returned to the country and thus became the king, ruling the planet Earth and performing various sacrifices to satisfy the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Vikukshi later became celebrated with the name Sashadha. The son of Sashadha was Paranjaya, who was also known as Indravaha and sometimes as Kakuksta. Please hear from me, Sukadev Goswami says, how he received different names for different activities. So this very significant event that occurred at a particular point in the history of the world. It is just one event. The son did something inappropriate and he was banished. And then see how karma turns. And then later on, when his father renounced, he came back and he became the king. So if we were there at that time, we see it as very, very significant. And we'll see, just see, he listened to his father. His father became angry, rightly or wrongly, told him to go. He accepted the punishment, he left. And then later on, he came back, his fortunes reversed, and he became the king, a great success story. But yet, it's only a success story on the material level. And all success stories on the material level ultimately end up, unless they're on the material level, as failure stories. Because then we see that his son was this and his son was that, and when he died, his son was that. So everyone's story on the material level, on the physical level, on the bodily level, must be a failure story, no matter how superficially, for some time, there is a success. So no one really should be enwrapped, his consciousness shouldn't really take success and failure as if it is everything in the material world. Because when we have some failure, we think, oh no, failure. And when we have some success, oh great, wonderful, success. But then, this is life. Successes come, failures come, successes come, failures come, happiness comes, misery comes. So therefore Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita suggests, he gives advice to Arjuna, tamstitikshas sabharata, agama payeno anityas. These things come and go. Sitosna sukatukadaha, like the summer comes, like the winter comes. If we only like the summer, then when winter comes, we're miserable. And if we only like the winter or something, then when the summer comes, we're unhappy. But these things are always passing. So what one is recommended to do, what Krishna recommends, is one tolerate these things. And not put one's energy into either enjoying, because if one tries to enjoy, when the absence on the material level, when the absence of the enjoyable ingredient is there, then one suffers. So rather than trying to enjoy in the material world, one should tolerate. Tamstitikshasvabharata. One should become tolerant of the natural ups and downs that must occur in the material world. Not focusing our full attention on that. Not thinking that the material happiness is the goal of life. But rather understand that the soul is eternal. And we should put our energy into realizing that. That is the recommendation of how to live a spiritual life. To be tolerant, do one's duty, but be tolerant on the material level. Because happiness and distress, they must come. Just like the winter and summer season, they come one after another. But we should not mistake that for our real life and the real purpose of life. So, now we talked about Ikshaku and his son Vikukshi, and this great disaster occurred. Yes, a disaster for him. He was exiled. But then he became king, success. But then he died and his son was there, and then his son came, and then his son came, and then his son came, and his son came. Keep tigers in the drain pipes just in case. What was that? Do you know? Okay. So formally, so this is the son of the Kukchi. Now we're up to speaking about him. He was celebrated as Sasada. So that's another simple point. He became very famous in his time. He was a powerful king. named Vikukshi. But now, who ever heard of Vikukshi, the powerful king? People are so involved in trying to become famous. I want to become a famous this and a famous that. A famous rock and roll star. But then in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, no one's ever heard of you. No one has fame in this world. It is not a worthwhile goal for man. So therefore, we should focus our mind on the spiritual goal, that which gives eternal benefit. That makes more sense. That which gained on the material level is lost in time, and that which is gained in the spiritual level is truly ours. So the son of Shashada was Puranjana, as we heard, who is also known as Indravaha, and sometimes as Kakukcha. Please hear from me how he received different names for different activities. Formerly, there was a devastating war between the demigods and the demons. The demigods, having been defeated, accepted Puranjana as their assistant and then conquered the demons. Therefore, this hero is known as Puranjaya, he who conquers the residents of the demons. Puranjaya agreed to kill all the demons. He was very powerful. On the condition that Indra, one of the demigods, the chief of the demigods, would be his carrier. Because of pride, Indra could not accept this proposal. He didn't want to take this lower position. But later, by the order of the Supreme Lord, Vishnu, Indra did accept it and became a great bull. Using his own mystic power, he became a great bull as a carrier for Puranjaya. Well protected by armor and desiring to fight, Puranjaya took up a transcendental bow and very sharp arrows. And while being highly praised by the demigods, he got up on the back of the bull, Indra, and sat on its hump. Thus he is known as Kakukstha. Being empowered by Lord Vishnu, who is the Supersoul and the Supreme Person, Puranjaya sat on the great bull and is therefore known as Indravaha. Surrounded by the demigods, he attacked the residents of the demons in the west. There was a fierce battle between the demons and Puranjaya. Indeed, it was so fierce that when one hears about it, one's hair stand on end. All the demons bold enough to come before Puranjaya were immediately sent to the residence of Yamaraj by his arrows. To save themselves from the blazing arrows of Indravaha, which resembled the flames of devastation at the end of the millennium, the demons who remained when the rest of their army were killed fled very quickly to their respective homes. And after conquering the enemy, the saintly king Puranjaya gave everything, including the enemy's riches and wives, to Indra, who carries a thunderbolt. For this he is celebrated as Puranjaya. Thus Puranjaya is known by different names because of his different activities. So very wonderful, even empowered by the Lord to do these, this conquering. But then the son of Puranjaya was known as Anena. Anena's son was Prithu. And Prithu's son was Vishwagandhi. So how many generations is that? Quickly passing like that. Gone, forgotten. Someone does a great deed. And actually, anyone who can do anything in this world that's substantial, this is power given by the Lord due to his piety. No one can do anything without Krishna's grace, without God's grace. So Vishwagandhi's son was Chandra, and Chandra's son was Yuvanaswa. The son of Yuvanaswa was Srivatsva, who constructed a township known as Srivastipuri. The son of Srivasti was Brihadasva, and his son was Kuvalayasva. In this way, the dynasty increased. To satisfy the sage Uttanka, the greatly powerful Kuvalayasva killed a demon named Dundu. He did this with the assistance of his 21,000 sons. O Maharaj Prickett, For this reason, Kuvalayasva is celebrated as Dundumar, the killer of Dundu. All but three of his sons, however, were burned to ashes by the fire emanating from Dundu's mouth. The remaining sons were Dvidasva, Kapilasva, and Bhadrasva. From Dvidasva came a son named Haryasva, whose son is celebrated as Nakumba. So one after another, after another, after another. And yet, when we're disturbed, or something is, or we have a problem, we think, oh, such a big problem. Such a big problem, as if it really was something extremely substantial. But actually, when things are looked at in the context of an actual long period of time, there are no big problems and there are no real achievements. So what to do in our life? Just survive? Just to survive and enjoy a little bit? No. There is an eternal purpose, because this is the first teaching of Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, Agama Payeno Nityas. Asochanan Vishochastam Pragyambaram Jabasate Gatasan Agatasan Stana Nanu Sochanti Patita Dehinosman Yatade Komaram Jovanam Dura. That we're eternal souls. So the son, Haryasva, whose son is Nakumba. The son of Nakumba was Bahulasva, the son of Bahulasva was Kritasva, the son of Kritasva was Senajit, the son of Senajit was Yuvanasva, Yuvanasva had no sons, and thus he retired from family life, went to the forest. Although Yuvanasva went to the forest with his 100 wives, all of them were very morose because they had no son. The sages in the forest, however, being very kind to the king, began very carefully and attentively performing an Indra Yajna, an Indra sacrifice, so that the king might have a son. Being thirsty one night, the king entered the arena of sacrifice. And when he saw all the Brahmins lying down, they were asleep. He was very thirsty. He got up in the middle of the night, was thirsty, everyone was sleeping, and they had been performing a sacrifice. They had sanctified some water that was very, very powerful, that would have the ability to give his wife sons. So he was very thirsty, and he personally drank the sanctified water meant to be drunk by his wife. What is going to happen next? When the Brahmanas got up from bed and saw the water pot empty, they inquired who had done this work of drinking the water meant for begetting a child. When the Brahmanas came to understand that the king, inspired by the supreme controller, had drunk the water, they all exclaimed, "Alas, the power of providence is real power, fate." They just raised their hand and say, "Who can understand fate?" And ultimately, one's fate dictates what will happen. So we may try to do one thing, but fate may take its own twist and give a completely different result. So the Brahmanas would perform the sacrifice. They were acknowledging this. The power of providence is real power. No one can counteract the power of the Supreme. In this way, they offered their respectful obeisances unto the Lord. Thereafter, in due course of time, a son with all good symptoms of a powerful king came forth from the lower right side of King Yuvanasva's abdomen. The baby cried so much for breast milk that all the Brahmanas were very unhappy. "Who will take care of this baby?" they said. Then Indra, who was worshipped in that yajna, came and solaced the baby. "Do not cry," Indra said. Then Indra put his index finger in the baby's mouth and said, you may drink me. Because Yuvanasva, the father of the baby, was blessed by the Brahmanas, he did not fall a victim to death. After this incident, he performed severe austerities and achieved perfection in that very spot. So this son of Yuvanashva, who was born in this another amazing way, his name was Mandatta. Mandatta, the son of Yuvanashva, was the cause of fear for Ravana and other thieves and rogues who caused anxiety. He was a powerful king. Well, King Parikit, Sukadeva Goswami said, because they feared him, the son of Yuvanashva was known as Trasadasyu. This name was given by King Indra. By the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the son of Yuvanashva was so powerful that when he became emperor, he ruled the entire world consisting of 7 islands. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is not different from the auspicious aspects of great sacrifices, such as the ingredients of the sacrifice, the chanting of Vedic mantras, the regulative principles, the performer, the priest, the result of the sacrifices, the arena of sacrifice, and the time of sacrifice. Knowing the principles of self-realization, Mandatta worshipped that transcendentally situated Supreme Soul, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Vishnu, who comprises all the demigods. He also gave immense charity to the brahmanas, and thus he performed jagya, sacrifice, to worship the Lord. All places from where the sun rises on the horizon, shining brilliantly, to where the sun sets are known as the possessions of the celebrated Mandatta, the son of Yuvanashva. Mandatta begot 3 sons in the womb of Bindumati, the daughter of Shashabindu. These sons were Purukusta, Ambarish, and Muchukunda, a great mystic yogi. These 3 brothers had 50 sisters who all accepted the great Subari Muni as their husband. So from now until the end of the chapter, and I think we'll just stop here, is the story of Subari Muni. Thank you. Any questions or comments? You have to capture them. Yeah. But a lot of the ninth canto, it seems like the way that the ninth canto goes, it's one after another, these little stories, and this one is the son of this one, and then every once in a while you get to a very significant person, and then it slows down, and you get a close up, and we hear in detail about that person and his wonderful deeds. Is that what you meant? Yeah, so we just finished that with Ambarish Maharaj. And that will happen again. There's a little in the story of Subari Muni is interesting. Then for a few chapters, there's Lord Ramachandra, the story of Lord Ram. And then there's interesting pastime for a few chapters on King Puravana, Pururava, and Parsaram. And then a very interesting pastime about King Yayati. But in between, there's all these generations get generated. Yeah, difference. But really, it's leading to all the dynasties lead to Krishna's birth, which is to come to in the last chapter 24. This canto. Any other questions or comments? Kalindi? No questions? Comments? Are you tired? Do you feel very peaceful though? Resting upon your father's knee? Nice, yeah? Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Shri Prabhupada ki jai.